What next? The world. So how does that feel? Kind of like the thought of going home, work, Tim Hortons or whatever. And what does that produce in the mind? And all you know is, well, that's what it produces. That's what it is now. And that, you know, this constant kind of practice that we're trying to do is awareness with the way things are. So awareness with the mood of the mind. So like I was this morning, it was 7:25. I was all dressed. Philip had coffeed me up. I was all ready. And my first thought, I want to go back to sleep. I was just watching. So how does one make a decision? And I could see, well, if I just let the laziness be there. And then I said, well, actually, it's going to be more fun meditating. So the decision was really just to be happy. It's interesting how we do make decisions. Where do they come from? And oftentimes we don't have maybe the time to investigate the choices that we make. Life comes at us and we react or whatever. But the choices we make are important because they do have results. So that's the law of karma, that whatever we do, for good or for ill, of that we will be the heirs. And inadvertence is no excuse. You know, if you're on the roof and you're doing the roof tiles and you're not belted up and it's wet and you slip down and you fall and you break your leg, you could say, well, I didn't mean to, but the law of gravity still works. So the law of karma still works. So the more aware we are of where we're coming from, the better the chance for good results. But that horrific story I gave you yesterday, you don't know. I was wondering, why did I give that story last night? Maybe it's just that sense of that this human birth is so valuable, you know, then it's so precious. And there's a kind of paradox in Buddhism. We kind of say, oh, no more rebirth, thanks. You know, there's a sort of put down of birth. With birth, there's death. With birth, there's old age, sickness and death. But there's also the other side, that human birth is incredibly auspicious and special. Because, why? Because we can reflect on the very nature of humanness, as it were. Develop that which is really beautiful and realize the kind of spiritual depths that the Buddha and other beings have shown us are possible. So that's the kind of raison d'etre of human birth in Buddhism. And it is incredibly valuable in human birth. So certainly those kinds of shocks and those kinds of when you hear someone is sick, or when someone dies, or when you yourself have some difficulty, you can kind of bring up in the mind, how well am I spending my time? So that the decisions we make are in line with our own well-being, really. They're not decisions like just to live out of obligation or live out of duty. That would be, you can only push duty so far. If there's no love of the work or no passion in the work, or, you know, all those kind of uplifting, you know, challenge, then duty just sort of oppresses one. So I know with my mom, taking care of her, I had a lot of filial piety, a lot of love of her. And it wasn't really a sense of duty. And although it was quite exhausting, I really, really, really was tired. Sometimes my brain just couldn't function. It wasn't really that difficult because there was a lot of love in it. And we can do a lot when that loving heart is there. And we have to take care of ourselves because we can burn out. So kind of doing meditation just out of a sense of duty. You know, I have to meditate. And, you know, I've got to put my meditation in and I have to diet. And I have to do my aerobics. And, you know, it's just like, but like the whole curiosity of the spiritual path is what, and the challenge, right? It's the challenge of being with sickness or keeping that? And how can I sustain awareness with, how can I practice awareness with this condition, with this anticipation, with this difficult state of mind, with this person? So there's always a sense of challenge you kind of up, what, bringing your game up, how do we say that? You, when you play tennis with a good tennis player, they raise your game. Raise your game, yeah, yeah. So challenges can raise your game. But not out of just a sense of, I have to push myself because I'm lazy. That won't work either. It was kind of interesting watching laziness this retreat. And then sometimes laziness was really appropriate. You say, shit, just lay down. Oh, thank you. I like you. And other times, yeah, but is it appropriate? So that, you know, that reflective capacity is really marvelous. And that's what we would say in Buddhism, is what makes a true human being. A biped isn't necessarily a human being. It could be a bird, or it could be, you know, a pretty vicious kind of creature on the planet. But the human capacity is the capacity, we'd say, is, you know, Homo sapiens idea, is this capacity to reflect on passion, on animal instincts, on more divine qualities like love and so on. And then this mysterious, curious, interesting thing about awareness or presence or whatever way we approach that. So I know with, like, taking care of my mom, I was religious about my meditation practice during that time. Religious in a sense of dutiful, I suppose, but I would sit every morning, every evening at least. And I had the time. I had the time to do it. I was sometimes tired, but that's seems to be one of the harder things to do in lay practice, is to keep up a sitting practice. Now, why is that important? Well, you know, people say, well, I was, you know, just practicing kind of just choiceless awareness. But there's something about sitting practice which does, it is a way of monitoring where your heart and mind is at, the things you've picked up in the day or in the last week or whatever, the kind of mind states that might be floating through consciousness. It gives you a real sense of where you're at, as it were. And then the wholesomeness of sitting practice is that you are quite intentionally developing strong states of awareness. Even though you might feel foggy and you don't want to do it, just raising consciousness that this is the way it is now, this is the way it is now, again and again and again. And then putting forth, like, determination, going against just the tendency of distraction, all those different kinds of things are very important, because they're the seeds of all that happening throughout the day. You know, the more intentionally I can practice awareness for half an hour with the breath or with the way things are, the more strong that intention to be aware is through the day. So it's not just about some meditative experience I have, but it's rather the inculcating or stimulating the factors to make you more aware through the day. But it seems to be a difficult self-discipline for many. Probably why I became a monk, one of the many reasons. I think you all know, if you have a group that's meditating and you are part of it, and you have a sense of duty to that group, you know, don't want to let people down, I'll go to the meditation. But when you're on your own, it's a bit more difficult. So I don't know how you beat that one. Just go for it, right? I know for myself, if I'm practicing on my own and I get, you know, I get into some kind of lazy mode, I just don't like myself. I say, you rice bag. So I'm quite motivated by the generosity of the laity. You know, like, I realize that my life is through the gifts of others. It's not, you know, I wouldn't do this if you wouldn't, you know, if the lay people didn't support us. So I have a lovely way of raising my game, as it were. But yeah, I can see, you know, laziness coming up and all of that. But the results are kind of, I don't like that. So the practice in the end comes just to being really more happy, more at ease and more happy and so on. So I just keep selling it. Whether you buy it or not, I don't know. That's all I can do. I used to kind of give instructions about how to eat, how to walk. I thought, gee, they're 60 years old. Give them a break. So I gave up on that one. And so like the awakened mind is just so wonderful, really. It really is. And then like practicing the awakened mind with the way the mind is, I think that's very important, with laziness. And then seeing if in that space good choices can be made. And if good choices aren't made, just getting the results of bad choices, you know, so you make a poor choice in some way, not necessarily immoral, just in the way of organizing a week or whatever, and you see the results. I don't really feel good in myself. Then register that. This is the result. This is the result of being heedless in some way. And rather than kind of beat yourself up, really make conscious. You know, just wait with it. It's hard to do that. You know, usually you like to go to the fridge or some kind of compensation. You know that story, we have a friend in Perth and she's really, really great. She sometimes uses food as a kind of compensation to negative states of mind. So she put on her fridge, "It's not in here." It's perfect. It's really clever. So like to be like if one has made just, you know, sloppy decisions where we all make them and then not to self-disparagement doesn't work either, because that's not really awareness. It just leads to more heedlessness. But to actually awaken to an uncomfortable result. To just, oh, this is the result. There's something about feeling that result, letting it be there, first of all, that grounds you in awareness. And that makes you very cautious in the future, because when the future possibility comes up for that error, your mind's there's going to be an alarm bell saying, "Yeah, you can do that, but you know where it's going to go," which isn't like guilt or and it's not those states of mind. It's a kind of caution. We call it hiriyotapa, the sense of conscience and fear of unskillful consequences. In a monastery, quite often there are two kind of protective deities, and they kind of look really, really tough, and they're called Hiri and Otapa. And Hiri Otapa is the kind of Pali words for a sense of conscience and not hurting others and not doing that which is wrong, and a sense of fear, but not in a kind of psychological way, and a sense of fear of the results of doing something in the law of karma. It's kind of maybe like the fear the native hunter has up in the Arctic. You know, if you're not careful, the polar bear is going to eat you. I don't know, not that strong, but you know, you get a sense of like, yeah, going that way is really unskillful. Don't go there. And that's healthy. Conscience also, you know, having done something which is unkind towards someone. Conscience is a kind of saving grace, isn't it, in the mind. So our moral life and our social life and our life of responsibility in relationships and in work and so on is governed by the heart, by a firm conviction in the law of karma, that there are consequences to actions, thoughts, words, deeds, which are intentional. There are consequences to that. If I say something to someone in a arrogant and aggressive way, there are going to be consequences. If I just happen to have a strong voice because maybe I've been doing pranayama and the person thinks I'm aggressive and takes it that way, that's their problem. Right? And they can say to me, "You were aggressive." And I said, "Actually, I was just doing pranayama." And I can say, "I'm sorry, mate, it's your mind." So if I'm mindful, I can't get intimidated. If I'm not mindful, you know, and someone says, you're arrogant. I said, "Was I arrogant? Yeah, maybe you're right, I'm sorry." You know, rather than saying, "Well, you know, wait, that's your mind." So you can be strong in this practice. You can be firm and strong. Why? Because you really know what's going on. You understand your own mind. You know where you're coming from. But if there's heedlessness and, you know, kinds of inattention to guilt things and all the complexity of our psyche, then of course it's much, much, much more difficult to be more clear. So presence shows you the way things are, and then the working out of these psychological factors makes the mind more and more clear, more and more present. And then the primal things of just being incarnate in a... What is it? Philip and I are trying to remember this line. I don't know, it was from Blake or someone, and then that one part in the poem said, chained to a dying animal. Consciousness chained to a dying animal. Very nice. But you know, we're going to be there more and more, you and I who have white hair, right? And yet, that's just the way it is. This is we're incarnate in an animal body. But that awareness is not, it's free. It is free. So the more we just let nature be the way it is and awaken to it, the more it's okay. The more it's okay. But when we're not awake, when we're really reactive, then of course it's we're just on the rim of the wheel all the time. I was talking to someone else. There's a property across the monastery, which if the person's not close to death, we've just brought up a policy in our committee that if that property comes for sale, we will try to acquire it. So we're trying to save up some percent of our income every year towards that. It might be in a few years' time, but I thought, well, it would be nice to start a Buddhist old folks home there. The trouble is, you'd need a pretty big home. So I don't think I'm going to do that. But it would be nice, to have like Kalyanamitta and the support of France. We'll see, whatever. We'll see how it goes. So, so thank you for hanging out with me through my head cold. And it's really, really nice to reconnect with all of you. And I really do wish this practice is a benefit to you and to your culture, to your society. It is a very simple thing. Very simple thing, but it's also very profound. So, without further ado, I think that'll be it for me. If anyone is interested in taking the five precepts, would anybody be interested in the five? Yeah. So we could do that now. So if you get the books. I'm sorry. They're in the chanting book. Yeah. Towards the back. Refuge isn't. So it's 72. So. So just to verbally go through them before we do them as a ritual, page 73, undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. So this is a reflection, and you're going to have, like with the precepts, there's someone wrote to me saying, I forget what it was. It was either ants or cockroaches or mice in my food. And the precept says, I'm not supposed to kill. What am I supposed to do? In this kind of demanding letter. I said, it's your problem. And it is. It's not my problem, lady. She kind of wrote to me saying, it's my fault, right? So the precepts aren't to make life comfortable. I'm going to do like 3.5, 3.25 precepts, thank you. Tomorrow I might do 4.8, because this one's uncomfortable. So the precepts are to awaken the mind to kinds of behavior which are unskillful and bring remorse and are hurtful in society. So that with the first precept, you get problems like with like in Thailand, you get infestation of termites, or in Amaravati, it had infestation of rats, and the health authority said, if you don't come in, we're going to close you down. So those are very real problems. You just have to deal with them as the best you can. So these are not absolutes. You know, they're not like absolutes. They're mirrors of reflection, so we do the least amount of harm possible. And then if we need to step outside of those, we still take responsibility. So if I'm the medical health officer in a hospital, and there's an infestation of rats, and the rats have to be eradicated, and I'm a Buddhist, well, I said, well, okay, I'll take the karmic result. I don't know what it is, but I'll do it for the sake of all these beings. But the precepts, they always stay the same, which is, I think, very important. You say, well, it's okay except for rats. You know, that's a slippery slope. Bed bugs, for me, it would be deer flies. Yeah. They are a challenge. So you see, the precept is always, no, you don't take the life of living creatures, but life is life. And each of us then has our moral dilemmas, and we do the best we can. But we always return to that. So it's like not absolutist, it's reflection. I take the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. Where that comes up a lot is in copyright, pirating information and DVDs and music and things like that. So the standard is impeccability in that way. So the mindset which says, it's a multinational, they make so much profit, Microsoft, you know, down with the big guys. And, well, yeah, but still stealing, right? So the kind of impeccability there as much as possible. I take the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct, so that would be fidelity in relationship, not approaching minors with kind of sexual intent, not approaching people who keep the 8 precepts with sexual intent, not like monastics and so on, fidelity as opposed to adultery, and not just being kind of obsessed with sexual energies, just seeing sexuality and understanding it in relationship. I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech, at least a one lifetime's work. It's a really, really challenging. So read the positive aspects of like speech which is in concord, speech which brings harmony, speech which is truthful. Those kinds of ideas, bring that into mind. Because speech is, it can be quite very beautiful. Words can be very beautiful, very, very, very painful, as we all know. You know, like, don't go for that send button if you're angry. You know, whatever you send is going to be, that's our policy in the monastery. Anything I send will be on the front page of the New York Times tomorrow. That's my mindset now. It's really, really, and it's just so easy to have a silly answer, a stupid answer, a passionate answer, and then, oh no, can't get it back. So a kind of caution around communication. But generally, the speech is just truthful and brings harmony rather than ripping people down, things like that. And then I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs, which is just carelessness, so abstaining from alcohol and grass and all the different things that, you know, acid and Romalar and the different things that exist now. They're a very hard age for that. Drugs which are used for psychotherapy, that's fine. But to just try to live with a sober mind, just the way it is. Also, abstaining from these things creates a certain aura in society. You know, a teetotaler is a teetotaler. This is the way I am. So creating that persona is very, very helpful in situations. Oh, come on, you know, it won't hurt you. It's, and also renunciation. So I remember when I proposed an Upasaka training in Ottawa with the groups, I had several French-Canadian people who were adamant that they're not going to give up their wine. I said, really? Okay. Yeah, well, I don't know. And so there's a rationalization. Well, you know, it's only 2%. But there's also the sense of renunciation in it. Am I willing to give something up? And so again, it's a reflection. It's not an absolute sense. So some people then won't take the precepts because they want to stay with their wine. And I think, well, that's an interesting one. What should I do with that? And I say, it's not my problem. So there's that. And I don't want to be some moral prude or something like that, but to take a standard which is ups your game and then to use it as reflection. So if one were to choose to use wine, that would be against the definition in the books. But you have your standard. At least have some standard around inebriation. And social culture, the kind of social culture hanging. So the precepts are meant as not so much a lockdown, as good wholesome reflections on what is good for the mind and what is good for society. And then the renunciant precepts, the 8 precepts, were around more monastic life, which we took for the retreat. You all know that stuff, but. Just a reminder. So why don't we? What I'll do is I'll do the Pali line by line with you, for those who want to do it, and then if you follow. So I'll chant the Namo Tassa 3 times, and then if you chant the Namo Tassa 3 times, so we pay homage to the Buddha. So this is also a way one defines taking up the Buddhist path. So homage to the Buddha is both that principle of enlightenment, but also respect for the teacher. Gratitude to the teacher, gratitude in that sense. So I'll do that 3 times, and then we'll go through the Pali of the refuges, line by line, and then we'll do the Pali and English of the precepts. So if you let me do Namo Tassa 3 times, when I've done it 3 times, then you follow suit. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang saranang gacchami. Tutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tisaranakamanang nititang amapante.
Flip over, and we'll do the Pali and English of the precepts.
Panatipata veramani. Sikapadang samadhiyami.
Annotate the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature.
Adina dana veramani sikapadang samadhiyami.
And take the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given.
Kamesu
vichachara veramani sikapadang samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. Musawada Vairamani Sikapadang Samadhyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech. Surameraya Macha Pamadatana Vairamani Sikapadang Samadhyami. And take the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness. Imani panchasikapadani silena sukatingyanti silena boga sampata silena nipotingyanti tasama silang visotaye. That's it for me. If you have a chance, come near Perth. Even if you're not near Perth, come anyway. Come visit the monastery.